This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 278 was recorded on July 1st, 2021, Canada Day, and I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. One River Asset Management CIO Eric Peters has been in the news quite a bit lately as his new venture, One River Digital, has become one of the most voracious buyers of Bitcoin. Eric returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss secular inflation and the digital currency revolution in detail. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick's chart deck is titled Looking Under the Hood.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, let's talk about these markets. S&P 500 finally made it above the 4,300 level as time of recording here. What's your take on this market?
Same thing, different day as far as I'm concerned, Patrick. All of the smartest logical arguments that anybody makes all say the market's way overvalued and it keeps going up anyway. Sounds to me like a crack-up boom and incipient secular inflation. And I think probably we've got a long ways to go. I think if this is inflation-driven, which is what I suspect, there's room for plenty of more upside. Eventually, this has to end very badly. I don't think these valuations make sense, but for now, the trend is up. Don't fight it.
All right, let's talk the U.S. dollar because that continues to edge upwards and looks like at least the trend that shifted in the post-FOMC has not really been given back. I mean, we're trading around 92.5 at the time of recording. That's a fresh multi-week high. What's your take on this?
Well, certainly the chart pattern, you know, looks visually kind of bullish looking, almost looks like a little micro time frame cup and handle pattern that's starting to form there. But overall, Patrick, I really don't have any strong view and I would never trade the dollar index here. You got to remember, it's a relative to other currencies. That's what we're measuring. And this is so policy dependent. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the only people that have any business trading the dollar index are going to be people who think they have inside information about upcoming policy decisions. I don't see how you could win that game without that information.
All right, let's talk crude oil because we had that fresh breakout today. We're at north of 75 at the moment, actually. This is really almost accelerating to the upside. What's your take on this oil? What was the reason for the move?
Patrick, we were above 76 briefly this morning, and I won't be surprised to see us get back up there. What's going on? Most of this week has been about anticipation up to the OPEC meeting. And so we had another big drawdown on crude oil inventories, 6.7 million barrels coming out of commercial inventory, 8.1 total if you include the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And of course, regular listeners know I think that's commercial oil, not government oil coming out. So I count all 8.1 as the drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.5 million barrels. Gasoline building 1.5 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 869,000 barrels. U.S. production ticking down 100,000 barrels to 11.1 million barrels. Overall, Patrick, the way I look at this oil market is we're getting into some very excited concern about physical supply of deliverable WTI in the summertime. So what the heck is with this UV spread, as traders call it? The difference in price between September and October is $1.30 as we're speaking today. That's a really huge differential. What's going on there? I think what this is about, Patrick, and a lot of people are struggling to figure out what it's about. I think it's about the grades of oil which are stored in Cushing not being deliverable against the WTI contract. In other words, the WTI contract specifies Cushing, Oklahoma as the location of delivery of oil, but it's not just any old oil. It has to meet a certain technical specification. And it just doesn't make sense that the time spreads are as wide as they are with so much oil in storage. The only explanation would be a lot of that oil in storage is not the right grade to deliver against WTI. That's my theory at the moment. Frankly, it's a speculation. I welcome any critical feedback on Twitter if people disagree. That's the best I can come up with. to explain what's driving this. Because normally these summertime blowouts in the spreads really are driven mostly by physical supply disruptions, things like pipeline spills, and we don't have that here. But I think it has to do with what kind of oil is in the tank. We'll see what happens with these. But right now, $1.30, that's a really, really wide spread. Although, generally speaking, those UV, the September, October, are often the widest spreads because that spread actually closes, ends up finishing trading in the middle of August, right at the potentially the seasonal height of the oil market. So it's going to be really interesting to see how much further this one has to go at $1.30 here of backwardation.
Let's touch on gold, because gold's been trade range bound for several weeks after that big move on after the FOMC, and it really doesn't seem like the bulls or bears have shown their hand for the next move. What's your take on the next move on gold?
Well, I strongly agree with the commentary that you just embedded in your question, Patrick. I think what's going on here is we kind of felt like, boy, the bull market is on. We took out the 100-day, then the 200-day moving average has really taken off. And then that FOMC statement really, really threw a monkey wrench in the works. And I think everybody's shell-shocked now. The bulls are afraid to go back to being bullish. And I think maybe the bears are afraid after that big rally that we had ever since March of how bearish they want to be. I think we're waiting to see what happens here. And I think it's probably going to be policy-driven. Personally, I'm hoping the next number is lower so I can buy some more. But I'm quite convinced the long-term outlook for gold is extremely bullish.
All right, and let's touch on that 10-year treasury yield, which also continues to be just pinned just below the 1.50 level on the yields. What's your thinking here?
Well, Patrick, as I've said before, I think the key is we're well below 1.7, which is about where people start freaking out. And as long as we stay down here, I don't think it matters that much. I'm not trying to trade any kind of yields from a speculative standpoint. I just watch them as a macro signal. As long as we're in between 1% and 1.7%, it's almost all the same to me. Although I would say that we're seeing more and more of what I would describe as a calming. More and more of the market is saying, okay, that fear we had of interest rates backing up and going to 5%. Okay, that was probably a false alarm. I think that's where the sentiment is. Let's see what happens in coming weeks.
This week's feature interview guest is Eric Peters. Eric, why did we get Eric back on the show this week?
Well, Eric Peters is one of the smartest macro guys that we know, and he kind of defected to the dark side of the force about a year or so ago, launching One River Digital. It really has become one of the most prestigious institutional custodians of cryptocurrency. Now, Eric Peters is a macro guy who I respect. I think he's very smart, and it's very interesting to me because I see the digital currency revolution, which is very real, a little differently than the Bitcoin maximalists. And I was surprised a little bit. Eric Peters was not the guy I would have expected to turn into a Bitcoin maxi. So I wanted to understand what was driving that, where he was coming from, and where he sees the inflation question that we've been pondering for, what, months now here on Macro Voices.
Well, Eric's interview with Eric Peters is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abaxx Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abaxx also produces Smarter Markets, a weekly podcast that airs every Saturday morning on all the major podcast platforms. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. Michelle Dennity's five-part series about the role of digital innovation in advancing the ESG economy is live now at smartermarketspod.com, and you can look for another terrific interview every Saturday morning. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app in order to listen to this free podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Eric Peters, Chief Investment Officer for One River Asset Management. Now, you know that part, but Eric is now also the CIO for One River Digital, and we'll be asking him about that too. Eric, it's great to have you back on the show. I have been asking almost every guest that we have the same opening question, which is, look, inflation. Janet says transitory, I say secular. I've been asking a lot of guests this, but I really want to point something out. A rule of mine, Eric, is you don't listen to the most well-spoken, cool-sounding pretty girl on CNBC. You listen to the people who actually saw stuff coming before they happened. You told me, I think 2 years ago, that you guys had become convinced at One River that secular inflation was coming, and I think you were launching a fund just to focus on inflation as a trend, a thematic inflation fund. Is that right? And I guess what I'm most interested in, what were you thinking back then when nobody was talking about inflation? Why did you see it as an issue? I guess Hugh Hendry was telling me about inflation then, but not too many people. You saw it before then. How is what you thought was going to happen then compared to what has happened? And what do you guys think is coming next since you kind of got it right so far?
Eric, it's great to chat again. And thanks for having me back. And I'm sure I'm not the most articulate person. So I guess I'd rather be a little early than articulate. But, you know, on the topic of inflation, it seemed to us inevitable. But to explain that, I think we kind of have to go back into what had caused disinflation, or at least very, very low and stable inflation, which is really the paradigm that we were in. And there are a few major macro drivers that have played out, honestly, over the course of my entire career. And so I started in 1989. And so at various points in time, and it's accelerated post 2000, but we've seen increased globalization. We've seen successive use of monetary policy to support the economy at every bout of economic weakness. We've seen this incredible proliferation of ever accelerating technology. And so, you know, all of those things together have created an environment where there's been a lot of leverage that's been built into the system. Wages have come down for the average worker, and a lot of jobs have been moved offshore. And yet financial assets have done incredibly well, because these dynamics are really beneficial to capital over labor. And the consequence of the kind of the complicated interaction between all these different forces, so globalization, the rise of faster technology, without which, incidentally, globalization wouldn't really have been possible at this scale, the offshoring of jobs and just pressure on labor relative to capital, with a central bank that was prepared and maybe even eager to step in and just support the economy at every wobble, led us to a place where financial asset prices were very expensive. The distribution between capital and labor was distorted heavily to capital over labor at a level that we haven't really seen since the late 1920s. And monetary policy had largely become impotent, meaning that it kind of lowering interest rates or doing more QE wasn't really supporting robust economic growth. It was becoming less and less effective over time, even as it was reasonably effective at pushing up asset prices. And so when you look at that overall setup, you go, well, wow, we're really approaching this major pressure point where the dominant policy of the last few decades, really my whole career, no longer is really working very well. And we have this distortion in the division of the economic spoils between capital and labor. And so whenever we get the next recession, God forbid depression, we're going to have to enter a new policy paradigm, because monetary policy is simply not going to work. It's not going to be effective enough. And so what will that policy paradigm be? It could be a couple things. One, we could really have a huge debt write-off and just start all over again. All right. And yet it was pretty obvious that the appetite for that politically is close to zero, or zero, effectively zero. And so if that was not a possibility, then what else would happen? And really the only big scalable answer is we'd need to have some kind of wild productivity boom, new technology, or we'd have to have a major fiscal stimulus. And so by default, it seemed to us that it was obvious that we'd hope for a major technological breakthrough, but we certainly nothing like that was on the horizon at the time. And so it seemed inevitable that we'd have a major fiscal stimulus. And if we had a major fiscal stimulus, that it would inevitably be supported by the central bank buying debt aggressively, because that's what they had been doing. And and the world seemed to have adjusted to that paradigm. So in that environment where you see a large fiscal expansion supported by an aggressive central bank with the intent to alleviate the debt burden for society overall, that definitionally you'd have to have higher inflation because the policy objective actually would be to create inflation, meaning it would be to debase the enormous pile of debt that had come to burden the economy and do that through just issuing more debt, stimulating the economy, creating deeply negative real interest rates, and ultimately debasing the currency. So those things just, they seemed inevitable. And, I don't want to say thankfully it's how it's played out. It's certainly thankfully for our portfolios, but I think it's neither good nor bad. It just was kind of an inevitability.
Eric, I'm going to make the argument that maybe the easy work is behind you and it gets hard from here, because I agree with you completely. I do think this is a secular inflation. But, we all have to think as professional investors about what if it turns out that we're wrong. And the thing is, I just think right now oil and copper and all of these other inflation hedge trades really look fantastic, unless Janet's right. If inflation is transitory, the reflation trade has already overshot, and all of these things are screaming short if we're wrong about this. But I don't think we are wrong about this. What do you do? Do you hedge these things with optionality in your portfolios? How do you handle that? What if actually Janet got something right and this really is transitory inflation?
Well, look, Janet's a very smart person, and my guess is she'll be both right and wrong, meaning it all depends on your time horizon. Inflation, if you look at the inflations of the past, certainly in the beginning stages of them, but even kind of in the meat or even toward the end, they're volatile periods. So the inflation rate doesn't climb a steady path like the S&P did for all these years, really. Inflation as it rises is very volatile and prone to people probably overhedging and then getting squeezed out of those positions. And so there clearly are aspects of this inflationary period that we've entered that are going to be transitory. Used car prices are not going to go up 50% every year. It's just, if they do, that would be a real problem. They're obviously not going to. Right. And so there will be supply responses to these, higher prices in various commodities. And so there will be periods where it will appear that inflation is moderating. But I think you have to stay focused on the policy objective here. The policy objective is, I think, quite clearly to unburden the economy. And this is not just the U.S. This is more of a global phenomena, really. Certainly, some countries are more subject to it than others in various degrees. But the policy objective is to unburden economies from a multi-decade, extraordinary kind of a debt expansion. And the way you do that is either through a massive deflationary event, which is a huge credit write-down, or it is through either a short burst of hyperinflation or a longer period of controlled inflation. And I would define controlled by a period where governments attempt to and succeed at engineering a rate of inflation that's pretty meaningful. Let's call that north of 3%. And at times it could go up. Right now it's higher than that, right? So, but a long period of material inflation while also keeping interest rates artificially low and well below those rates of inflation. And if you do that for 10 or 15 or 20 years, then before you know it, your whole economy becomes less burdened or even unburdened from these debts. And if you're lucky, somewhere along that path, you get some type of real productivity burst that lifts the economy and things get better. So I think that's the objective. And so when there's such a clear objective, I think to think that it's going to be transitory, it just doesn't make sense to me. Now, I think if you believe that it's going to truly be transitory, what you're saying is that you think that policy will fail in its intent. And I don't think, I think at this stage, with a government that's been willing to run deficits of 15% really for 2 years in a row, fully funded more or less by the Fed, I think to think that these guys are going to fail and just succumb to the Japanese experience seems highly unlikely.
Eric, let's carry that forward and talk about how it might play out, because I agree with you completely. Let's assume the government's intention is what some people call slowly inflating away the real purchasing value of the national debt, of the public debt. That's what we're talking about here. If that's going to be the agenda and it's going to lead to ongoing systemic and secular inflation, how long does it take, do you think, before there are potentially adverse consequences of maybe that not going quite the way they planned it? And what are those consequences? What are the things that could go wrong with that plan?
Well, that's where it gets interesting, right? So, and I say interesting, I'd say where it gets interesting to me, just being a student of the history of money and markets. And it's interesting because we live in a world of fiat currency, right? So there's nothing backing currency other than people's faith in it. And so we're running a major experiment. We're running an experiment. We say, well, we think, I say we meaning policymakers, politicians, we think that we can attempt this experiment, meaning we can engineer inflation that is at a much higher rate than the interest rates that we suppress and create this negative real interest rate, which is effectively a huge tax on capital, right? Because if you own these bonds, or unless you are investing in something that is creating a return in excess of that inflation, your capital is really being taxed. And so they're running this experiment at scale in a world of fiat. And yet we don't really understand, you know, for how long people will have faith in, you know, in this paper money system. We just don't know. I definitely don't know. And I think what happened post 08 was that there were an awful lot of smart people who thought that once we entered this world of QE, that actually we would have a huge inflation. And really the reason for that was because they thought that people would lose faith in fiat. And that ended up being wrong. And so what happened was, you know, the Fed did do QE. They bought a lot of bonds, created a lot of money, but that money just, that had no velocity in the banking system. And so I think what's happened post 08 is that the voices that were concerned about a major inflation were more or less silenced just because they were wrong for, you know, a significant period of time. And that has given policymakers and politicians the courage to just say, well, we think that we can do this experiment, and we can actually not only do QE, but also do it with massive government deficits. And it probably still won't create a runaway inflation, a runaway inflation is really people losing faith in a currency. So I think that the politicians and the policymakers, having experienced this unique episode post 08, where they created a lot of money and there was no velocity of that money and it didn't create a real loss in faith in the currency, they feel that they can push that experiment a step forward. And I would argue that they've now done something that is just, it's so unorthodox, it's hard to even characterize it really and put it in a historical perspective, what's happening right now from a policy perspective. But that's the bet that they're making. They're making the bet that they can do this without people losing faith in the currency. And if they're right, then I think it will be a reasonably, then it's a smart policy, and we'll look back and say that was good. They unburdened the economy from all this debt. They taxed capital, meaning the people that have a lot of money that had saved it in various forms, they've taxed that. And so they've restored greater balance between the rich and the poor, and the economy is just healthier. You know, let's call it, close your eyes and say that's where we are in a decade. That will have ended up working out really well. The risk is that somewhere along that way, people go, you know what, I'm tired of my capital being taxed, and I'm gonna move it out of bonds and move it out of this currency into other things. And that's where you get a real discontinuous market event. And we don't know whether that will happen, but that's the risk.
I'd like to run a couple of thoughts by you, because a lot of people, myself included, have been a little bit skeptical of current policy, because we feel that, you know, they really are trying to solve a lot of problems with a printing press that I don't think can be solved with a printing press. My peers and colleagues who hold this view are telling me, you know, it's all going to blow up by next year. It's going to be a mess. I don't think so, Eric. I think that if you do this agenda that we've begun on already, it's not might happen. It's already clearly the wheels are turning. I think what happens is it looks absolutely beautiful for the economy for several years before everything blows up. And I do think everything blows up eventually, but I think it could be lots of years before that happens. And I know how politicians think, which is if it happens on the next guy's watch, I don't care. Would you agree with that? And the big question I try to get my head around is how many years are we talking about before the good inflation turns into really bad inflation?
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with the premise to start with?
Well, let's start with the position of humility, which is that this is an experiment at a scale that we have never seen. And so we don't know how it'll play out. And anyone who says they know exactly how it'll play out is either too confident or, you know, just pretending. So look, we're throwing an incredible amount of money at the economy. And it's a bit difficult for me to see how that in the end isn't good for the economy. There's a difference between what's good for the real economy and what's good for financial asset prices. And so that's one of the interesting things that we'll have to contend with. In other words, it could be the case that we end up with a reasonably strong economy or potentially an overheating economy, real economy, and that actually ends up being quite good at achieving one of the other objectives that politicians and policymakers have right now, which is to restore balance between how the economic spoils are divided between capital and labor. And one of the ways you do that, like if you think about it at the extreme, one of the ways that you really do that is you get people who are workers paid a lot of money, and that in effect creates a form of tax on capital, right? Because if everyone has to pay their workers lots of money and or has to somehow give them more benefits in some kind of way, and even if they don't do it directly, the corporations do it because they're taxed and then the government provides those services or those economic supports. If all that happens, you could imagine you could easily imagine an environment where labor does well and capital does not do well. Capital at the highest level, meaning maybe equities don't do well. Maybe, you know, imagine a world where bonds have deeply negative real rates, right? So, and that goes on for a long period of time, means anyone who owns bonds ends up losing real purchasing power over time. And imagine equities don't do well because profit margins are perpetually shrinking because either through taxation or higher wages or higher input costs, they just, you know, they earn less money. And then over time, those multiples decline because investors look at it as more or less a more permanent feature. And then as the years roll on, they start worrying that not only is it more or less a permanent feature, but ultimately it leads to a bad inflation. And so why do we want to own stocks, which are a long duration asset, in advance of something that we think is going to go wrong a few years hence? So those are not forecasts. Those are just, I think those are the inputs into how to think about the coming years.
Eric, I want to talk about where all this is headed, because as you said, what has to happen, it seems, is we're probably going to have secular inflation that debases the U.S. dollar and other fiat currencies. Fiat currencies haven't gone away as the gold bugs predicted, but I'll tell you, there's something that's very, very clear to me, which is the invention of the secure digital bearer asset, originally invented by the Bitcoin crowd, is a game changer. And it's a game changer which I'm going to argue the finance industry hasn't even begun to figure out yet, because frankly, they're still fascinated with these cryptocurrencies that I think are a waste of time. I know you disagree, and I want to get your view on that in just a second. But I think digital currency is going to really, over the next 25, 30 years, completely change the entire face of finance, and it's going to redefine not just we're going to replace the paper money with digital money, but what money itself is. Its functionality is going to evolve and change at computer speed. If you think about how things in the real world change versus how quickly things on websites change, I think how money works is going to start evolving. What I'm going to argue is maybe too fast, because the people who understand it are going to exploit that understanding, not to the benefit of the rest of society around them. And quite frankly, you know, I was a tech CEO, a software CEO in the 90s. I thought it was impossible for finance guys to be more confused about technology than they were in the late 90s. I didn't think it was possible. But boy, crypto sure has confused them, hasn't it? Do you agree with me that digital, and I don't want to get to crypto versus CBDC yet, but would you agree that digital currency, regardless of whether it's government or private minted, is likely to long-term replace all fiat currency? That's my outlook. Would you agree? And if so, why do you think it's true?
I think it's inevitable. So I, you know, rarely or almost, yeah, I mean, rarely do I say something is 100% certain, but what you just said, I think is 100% certain.
They don't get much closer than this one, do they? I mean, in terms of those certainties.
Yeah. But look, the whole world is moving into a digital age, and we see it all around us. It's advancing, and it's advancing at a really swift pace. And in fact, our kids are more and more living in, you know, spending a decent amount of time in their lives living, like literally living in digital virtual worlds. And that's, you know, that's only going to increase. And so part of it is just the world is just moving in that direction. It's more efficient. But there's also the issue that you know, paper money, for all of the concerns that people have and that the media has around Bitcoin, for instance, paper money is really, it's difficult to trace. And so governments like the ability to create money. It gives them the power of seniorage, meaning they can just create money out of thin air and then use it. And they do, you know, every year they do to large degree or relatively small degree, depending on the country. But they can still do that in a digital world, of course. In fact, it becomes easier. And so by transitioning to a digital world, they don't give up power. In fact, they gain power. And one of the great powers that they gain is through being able to track and trace every transaction that happens. And so it's no surprise that, at least no surprise to me, that in, you know, kind of 2015, 16, 17, a bunch of really smart young Americans and Canadians traveled around the world talking to every government that was willing to listen about these new technologies and how they could be applied to finance and money. And of all the governments in the world that listened to them, is the Chinese that took it most seriously. And they more or less right out of the gate said, all right, we need to start working on a digital currency. Why? Why would they do that? And it wasn't because they wanted to save money on paper. It was because these, you know, by digitizing currencies, if you can control them in a centralized way, which is the choice that the Chinese have made, then you have enormous amounts of data. You actually can, and you can use that to dominate your people, you know, all the way to the end of the road. And so that's what the Chinese have done. So I think they answered the question for you. In other words, the reason that the Chinese want to do this is because it gives them power, and governments throughout history rarely shed power. They accumulate it. And so these new technologies give governments more power. Now they can be, governments can choose to limit their access to this data and things like that. And hopefully the U.S. will not use this data the way the Chinese are using it against their people.
No, the U.S. has never used data against its own people. That's ridiculous. We're talking about America. Come on.
Right. But okay. No, I get it. Look, these are going to be some of the issues that we really have to contend with in the coming years and decades. But at least in the U.S., you still need a search warrant for certain things, right? It's not, I mean, China doesn't need any of that at all. And so they truly can use these technologies to dominate their citizenry. And the U.S. and every country in the world will have similar or the same ability. And hopefully in more democratic nations, there'll be healthy checks and balances. But this is going to give governments enormous new powers. And so they're going to take it. And that's, the end of the day, that's why, right? Paper's cheap. Printing money is not super efficient relative to just, you know, clicking a button. But it won't be because of efficiency at the government level. It will be because of power, I think.
Okay, Eric, I think that you and I agree very strongly that what's going on here, when you look back to the invention of Bitcoin years ago, the way I looked at it and the way it sounds like you looked at it is very similar, which is, hey, it's kind of cool that these libertarians invented this thing that's all about not having the government track all of your transactions. But in the process of doing so, they invented and published the instructions for how to use technology that governments are going to get their hands on. And they're going, it's very easy to predict, they're eventually going to do what's now called CBDC, Central Bank Digital Currencies, where the government is the issuer of the digital currency. Seeing that same view that you and I both have, because you just expressed it, 3 years ago when I wrote my book, my take was, look, everybody is just super hyper-focused on the first example of this, which is Bitcoin. But really, the likely trend is that governments are going to assert their power. They'll probably, you know, outlaw the cryptocurrencies at some point. Of course, they won't go away. They'll still be used illegally, even if they're outlawed. But probably governments are going to kind of take over and say, now we got the monopoly on issuing money. Forget about all these cryptocurrencies. We're going to issue government-issued ones. Sounds like you and I both see that future as the most likely outcome. Yet my reaction to it was, therefore, everybody's overpaying for this Bitcoin stuff. It's not going to be nearly as popular as they think it's going to be in the future. So if anything, you know, you don't want to be really chasing Bitcoin. You took the same data and you didn't just buy some Bitcoin for yourself, Eric. You made news becoming the mover of the market who, at least according to Zero Hedge, was buying more Bitcoin in that last rally than anybody else. So you've definitely got a view that Bitcoin is going to benefit, despite the fact that I think we see it the same way, which is eventually governments are going to, I think, crowd out the cryptocurrencies, and sovereign digital currency is going to be the big winner here. Why do we see it differently, or what am I getting that's different from the way you see this?
Well, there's a lot there. So, okay, a few things. Central bank digital currencies are likely in many countries, but they're not inevitable in every country. I think that there's a very material probability that the U.S. does not issue a central bank digital currency, and that rather the U.S. allows for private sector equivalents, and so that will be highly regulated by the U.S., but that we don't actually implement a central bank digital currency itself. And if that's the direction that the U.S. goes in, functionally from a consumer standpoint or banking standpoint, they'll be pretty similar, meaning that you'll just operate with digital currency as opposed to paper currency. And the settlement process and all these kind of things will be much more efficient, much cheaper, and all that's great. But if you have a central bank digital currency, really, when you think through what that means, inevitably you end up having a banking relationship with the central bank. And I think the U.S., the Fed, hopefully, well, I think the Fed doesn't really want to have a direct banking relationship with individuals, but it also creates a lot of complications in the whole banking system, because if you have a vibrant private banking system and you have a central bank digital currency, and what will happen is anytime people get worried about the solvency of the banking system, they'll just plow their money into their central bank digital currency account, and the banking system will face a run on the bank. And so these are kind of more technical reasons why there are more complications with that structure than you might think, and why I also think that the U.S. probably ends up with a private sector solution. It doesn't mean that private companies are just creating money and doing whatever they want to do. They'll all be heavily regulated, but I think it probably remains in the private sector. So that's what I see on the central bank digital currency side, but that's very fluid. And so who knows what decisions ultimately are made. There's not going to be a U.S. central bank digital currency anytime in the next year or two, anything like that at scale. So if we go down that path, it'll be over many, many years. In terms of how to think about something like Bitcoin next to that or replacing it, I really don't think that the U.S. is going to make Bitcoin illegal. If I did, I wouldn't have invested. You know, we wouldn't have made the investments that we did. And incidentally, you know, the investments that we made were in early November, just after the election, with Bitcoin around 15,000. So anyhow, I, like you, saw the invention of Bitcoin and kind of marveled at it. To me, when I looked at it years ago, it was so obviously the future of money that I thought it would be highly unlikely, not a zero probability, but highly unlikely that it would be allowed to coexist next to fiat currency, just because it seemed that Bitcoin in its full expression would be a viable competitor to the US dollar or any other sovereign currency, and therefore sovereigns just wouldn't want it to exist and would therefore try to stop it from existing. And so in many respects, I thought the beauty of the invention was so substantial that in it contained the seed of its failure. But what I think has happened over the years is that either through neglect, or let's call it neglect and not incompetence, but perhaps through neglect, governments just didn't stop it in time. And so now it's big enough that the cost to governments, more or less, of trying to make it illegal, because governments can't shut it down, to your point. Even if you made it illegal, the whole network would still operate. The price would be lower, for sure, for a time anyway. But you can't stop it. So you have to look at it. What are the costs and the benefits to governments of making it illegal? And the costs are that, number one, there's something like 140 million people around the world who own Bitcoin right now. And they're not all in the U.S., of course, but there are an awful lot of people in the U.S. and their institutions and their futures that trade on this. There, a lot of people would lose a lot of money. And there are a lot of strong advocates in Washington, D.C., for Bitcoin, and it forms one of the core assets of this whole new asset class that contains tons of innovation that if embraced, I think will benefit the whole US financial system, the US economy, and our place in the world. And so if you try to shut that down, you cede an advantage to your competitors internationally and also your adversaries. So that's the cost, is that you cede that advantage. There's also a cost that if you cede that advantage and others start to overtake you, that you then have to reverse that policy. And that's deeply humiliating for a government. So there's a significant cost to the government of shutting it down. So then how do they think about mitigating that? And if they feel like these assets perhaps threaten their power, what would be the logical response? And I think what you're seeing in regulation now is that logical response. What you then try to do is say, okay, if we could theoretically make it illegal, but we're not, but we don't want to bear that cost, how can we mitigate it? And what they do is they go, well, let's make it transparent. So let's make sure that we understand who owns what. And once they do that, then the government always holds the right to tax these assets at even exorbitant rates if they choose to. And so ironically, it doesn't behoove the government to shut these assets down now that they've gotten past this point where they're widely adopted. What they do need to do, though, is figure out who has them, who owns them, how much do they own? And now they have this huge pool of capital gains that they can tax. And so we know governments like to have huge pools of capital gains to tax. And so this is just another one of those.
Let's talk about where this is headed in our views. I think they're very similar. I talked in my book about what I call SVDCs, Silicon Valley Digital Currencies. And what I mean by that, I think, is a little different than what you described. I think the way you were describing this was maybe the government would be in charge of things and would kind of say, okay, we're going to invite contractors to come give us a bid to do X, Y, and Z. I don't know if that's what you meant, but I don't see it going down that way. What I see is enterprising Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, and certainly Facebook with the Libra project is an early example of this, saying, hey, the whole world is trying to figure out that clearly the US dollar is the world's reserve currency, is going to be replaced by a digital currency, and nobody can figure out which one it is or how it works yet. Let's make it us. And I think it's a power grab. I think it, you know, the folks that are in charge of social media already control too much influence on the world. I think they're about to get a whole lot more if they can do, and I don't know if this is what you were thinking, but the way I see it going down is these things start out as a private payment system, and then as you get pressure on the U.S. dollar, as more people are using digital, there's kind of a deal that gets made between Facebook or Google or whoever owns the digital currency system, the U.S. government saying, look, we'll make this the digital dollar, you'll license it, and we'll operate it for you. Is that kind of what you were thinking, or do you see it going down differently?
I think it's a bit differently, but I think the dynamic that you just described is partially what I see. So I see, like in any kind of or quasi-free market, I don't think we have a perfectly free market, but we still have a market that invites innovation. And there will be various firms that come up with different ways to create a digital dollar. There are already those. Tether is the biggest one, but it operates offshore. And I think that the U.S. government is becoming increasingly uncomfortable with that structure where there's, it's almost like a shadow banking system that is creating dollars that are used in the digital ecosystem. Now, right now, those dollars are not used to go out, those digital dollars, they're called Tether. They're not being used to go buy coffee or groceries. They're being used in crypto exchanges to exchange from, let's say, Bitcoin into Tether and then Tether into Ethereum or Ether rather. So they're being used in all kinds of ways in this digital currency system. But the government is, I think, has looked and has been really surprised at how quickly these forms of private sector digital dollars have grown. And the velocity in these is just stunning, meaning there are $60 or $70 billion worth of Tether out there. But the velocity is wild. So, you know, these things are changing hands multiple times a day. So the government is paying attention to this. What I'm saying is that they're not going to go out to private. I don't see them going out to private companies and saying, listen, we want a digital dollar. You guys run this for us and we'll bid it out and we'll pay you to do it. I think there'll be different types of digital dollars that spring up in the private sector. And the U.S. government will say, listen, if you want to operate in dollars, then you're going to have to fall under our regulatory umbrella. And we're going to make sure that the way you operate is, you know, we're comfortable with the security of that. We're comfortable with the collateral that underpins that. And that all of those things are going to be built such that, you know, a dollar is worth a dollar is worth a dollar, whether it's digital or paper. And eventually it'll all become digital. But that's just different from a centralized, you know, kind of a centralized central bank digital currency like the Chinese are doing. It's not that it's decentral. It's just it's kind of operated by the private sector as opposed to operated by the U.S. government. It's just, in this case, it's just regulated by the U.S. government.
Now, One River Digital is not just in this market. You're a big player in the crypto market for Bitcoin. Are you also investing in DeFi companies that are looking at using distributed ledger technology to do other things in finance? Is that part of it in your vision, or do you see this as mostly a currency play?
We are not investing in private companies at our firm. I think that, you know, there are other firms, obviously, that are doing a lot of that. And I think some of those firms will have enormous success because what's happening now and what has happened with the invention of Bitcoin, I think should be viewed as a true black swan, meaning this is a new type of technology that allows for something that humans have not to this date in our history been able to do, which is just decentralize these trust systems. So our entire society and most of our economies are built on this notion that we need to have centralized control of some sort so that there can be a trusted central authority on whatever it is that we're doing. And so imagine a stock exchange, imagine the New York Stock Exchange is that central authority that allows all sorts of people to come together and, you know, and trade stocks. And they're sitting there in the middle of that. And a credit card company is some type of centralized company. Art gallery is a centralized type of structure. So is government, right? And so there are all sorts of different organizations and structures throughout society that we have just, you know, as a species have come together and said, well, this is the right way of organizing our activities, is to have the central control or authority on something. And now these technologies have come along and said, those are, you actually don't need to do it that way. And we have the technology that allows us to do it in a different way. And I don't know what that will all lead to, but it's fair to say that when we look back in a few decades from now, we'll look at this as being an absolutely earth-shattering kind of moment where a lot of the assumptions we've made over hundreds or even thousands of years around how we have to organize ourselves and build these trust systems was changed through these new technologies. And so what that will lead to, I don't know. I don't. But I think a lot of these DeFi apps or DeFi protocols, a lot of them will end up being worthless, but some of them will end up being incredibly valuable. And I think the digital assets that we're investing in right now, we're an institutional asset manager, so we're not trafficking in really obscure little protocols. And, you know, that's more for venture capital type investors. We're focused on the bigger assets in this space. And we think that they'll be worth a lot more money as the things that I just described become to be more apparent to people. I think that process is only just beginning. There's a ton of skepticism. There's still this regulatory uncertainty. There are way more questions than answers, but like anything, those things start getting answered and uncertainty starts lifting. And as that happens, I think these assets will become much, much more valuable.
Well, Eric, I can't thank you enough, as always, for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit more because it's changed. Last time we talked to you, it was just One River Asset Management. One River Digital is just a brand name or it's a separate company? And what else is going on? Tell us, is the inflation fund happening? Give us the rundown.
Yeah, so we started One River Digital Asset Management as a subsidiary of One River Asset Management. And so we're still one, you know, cohesive firm. We thought that some of our clients might, just due to the uncertainty around digital assets, they might value us separating that part of the business out into a different entity. But I think ultimately where all this leads is asset management becomes fully digital in time. So I started that thinking that we would be the leading, or we would certainly aspire to be the leading asset manager in digital assets. And what I think increasingly come to realize is that all really successful asset managers in the future will be digital asset managers, even if they operate across all asset classes. And we are a firm that operates across every asset class. So, you know, we're growing quite quickly, and it's a lot of fun. It's just so interesting to be involved in new things. And you know, this new asset class, while it is a new asset class, it feeds into this whole macro story. So I really don't think that you can understand fully, and well, no one can understand fully. I don't think you can understand properly what's happening in macro markets without really understanding what's happening in digital assets and these new technologies. And then on the inflation strategy, it took time, but we've gotten it off the ground. So really excited about that. That, you know, like anything, it's harder to raise money and get backing for a strategy if not that many people, you know, see that risk as manifesting. But now that it's becoming more apparent, we have gotten that off the ground, which is terrific. And we're seeing a lot of interest in that.
Eric, I look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of freelancer.com. Listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Eric Peters on the show, just because getting his update just on his views on inflation. I know he came onto the show in the years past and talked about that big inflation narrative. And so really interesting to see some of those themes finally come to fruition. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, I agree with Eric with respect to inflation. I definitely think we have a secular inflation coming. On the other hand, I see the crypto stuff a little differently, but it's very interesting to me to see how people are processing this. You know, it's very clear to me we have a future ahead of us where the entire finance industry has to be transformed so that we replace both the currency and all of the exchange-traded financial instruments are all going to be replaced with decentralized finance someday. Probably not blockchain-based is my prediction, the way everybody else thinks it is. I think it'll be a better distributed ledger that doesn't require proof of work. But, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how this folds out. And I don't think there's really any more important question in finance long-term than how is the decentralized finance revolution going to unfold. That could be a podcast unto itself. Anyway, Patrick, let's move on to the post-game chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the link to the chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, the topic is looking under the hood. What's under there?
Well, let's take a look. The interesting part that I wanted to talk about is everyone's looking at these 52-week highs on the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. But it really is not a very broad rally. So let's start with chart two and look at the S&P 500, which has followed the pattern that it's been for the last 6 months, which is we've had a correction. It came down towards a 50% retracement in this 50-day moving average, found support, immediately broke higher, and is now making those 52-week highs. And so it looks like that the bull market is just following the typical pattern all year long. But what's really interesting is when we look at page three and we look at the S&P 500 equal weight ETF, what you can observe is that when we take out the overweight in those largest companies, and particularly the FANGs, we haven't even made higher highs on that equal weight S&P 500. And that's the case even on page four when we take a look at that Russell 2000. And so what we really have is a rally that isn't as broad as everyone thinks. And what's interesting is that the best and most evident way to illustrate that is on page five, when we look at the New York Stock Exchange's percentage of stocks that are above their 50-day moving averages. And what's interesting is that in spite of the S&P 500 making these fresh highs and this beautiful trend, we actually have a breakdown in the breadth of the market. We're basically reaching a point where only 50% of stocks on the New York Stock Exchange are maintaining above their 50-day moving average. This type of divergence is just demonstrating how narrow of a rally this really is.
Now, I want to push back on that one, Patrick, and ask you for a little bit more perspective on what that means, because I could say, well, okay, that sounds like a sign that maybe what's going on here is this market's about to crash. There's been this breadth divergence, which historically is a sign of problems in stock markets. We know there's a lot of people that have made very cogent arguments for why this market's overvalued and ready for a big correction, if not a bear market. But look, I think the biggest macro factor here is secular inflation driving a crack up boom. So how do you make sense of what you just said, which is, okay, there's this big divergence with respect to breadth in the market? Is that necessarily a bearish signal?
Well, I don't know if I would interpret it as outright bearish. What it really is telling us is, like on page six, when we look at that NASDAQ chart, what we had is sector rotation. And what we had before was a very broad market rally that had all of the cyclicals, all of the, particularly the energy sectors, the mining sectors, the financial sector. And there was this huge rally where the broad part of the market was participating on the upside. But since that FOMC, like we talked about over the last 2 weeks, what we've seen is a correction ensue in all those sectors, the cyclical sectors, and almost all of the money flow heading toward the FANG stocks. And it's really been this robust rally in the primary FANG stocks, the Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Google stocks. They've really been, and because they're such huge market cap behemoths, they're driving the two indices higher just because of their sheer size and weight. And so I think that this breadth is reflecting that rotation, the fact that we are seeing that that cyclical part selling. Now, the bigger question from your inflation perspective, I mean, if we are going to see another impulse in the reflation trade, we would see that money start to flow back into those cyclicals, and that would strengthen the breadth of the market. And so I don't necessarily want to imply that this is bearish and that the market has to crash because of this divergence, but rather is simply reflecting the fact that there's only one part of the market that's rallying, and that's really the big behemoth FANG stocks, and everything else is really stuck in the mud.
And that's the part that really just puzzles me about this market is I think back, at least, you know, I haven't done a lot of research on this, but historically off the top of my head, it seems like when you've got those popular stocks, the Apples and, you know, the FANG stocks and so forth, and that's what's rallying, what it means is the smart people stopped buying stocks, and it's just the dumb people that only know about the big names that housewives know about that are buying anything, and it's time to, you know, short the market and get ready for the big crash. I don't think it's time to short the market, Patrick. I think there's more melt-up risk than there is crash risk, even as much as I think we're overvalued. So what do we do with that? Or how do you navigate that in terms of putting the trades on that take advantage of what edge we do have here?
Well, I think that rotation is not just mom and pop retail investors chasing FANG. I actually think that it's a bigger rotation where there was a substantial overweight amongst investors and money managers into those cyclicals. And I think that it might just simply be a rebalancing of going from overweight cyclicals to even just equal weight and just money rotating back into that growth narrative. Like Harley Bassman, when he was on the show, talking about those kind of growth momentum stocks being the equivalent of like 70-year duration bonds. It's this idea that once we've seen yields backing off and bonds really basing, it may very well be that that there's speculation that we're going to see this part of the market once again outperform. And that least certainly has been the case for the last 2 weeks. And it's one of the biggest puzzle pieces to solve as to whether this is just short term, you know, a 1 month trend, or whether this is going to become something bigger or more sustained throughout the rest of the year.
Patrick, let's move on to page seven and the Nikkei, the Japanese stock index. What's going on there?
Well, this is just in the same theme. What I was trying to illustrate was is that while it feels like the stock market is rallying, somebody who's been invested globally and you have a pretty diversified portfolio of developed markets, emerging markets, and even, let's say, equal weight S&P, you've simply not seen any real equity participation on the upside over the last month. It really has been either you own the NASDAQ or you don't. And so to illustrate this, you can see, like, the Nikkei has more or less been stuck in a sideways trade range for almost the entire year. When you look at the Euro stock in, on page eight, while it's certainly been an uptrend, really the last month has been just a correction and consolidation downwards in Europe. But take a look on page nine when we look at the China A50. And China put in its top in February and has just been in a deep consolidation, not being able to find any buying. And at the same time, and this very similar to that chart on the Nikkei, when you're looking at just the emerging market space with the EEM ETF as well, just been stuck in the mud trading sideways for close to 6 months. And so you have a scenario where equity participation has been in a very narrow space. And now I kind of look at it two ways. Number one, maybe that is telling us that things could be potentially toppy and that some sort of a correction may be imminent. But alternatively, one could look at it bullishly and say, well, the market just hasn't participated yet. So if any of these markets start to join the bull party, then maybe the bull leg hasn't even begun. You know, I guess that's all about whether you want to look at the glass half full or half empty. But really, I think the theme of what I really wanted to capture in these charts is that there is only a bull market in the NASDAQ, and everything else is just been stuck in the mud, and it probably will continue to be a very quiet summer until a catalyst emerges to wake up these markets and begin something.
Patrick, slide 11 is a familiar one to me because we're looking at a comparison of the various different ETFs that can be used to invest in the energy sector, not in oil itself, but in the companies. So we've got the XLE, which is probably the most popular energy-related ETF. Then we've got several others. The OIH is the ETF that tracks companies that provide services to oil and gas, companies like Schlumberger and Halliburton and so forth. And then we've got XOP. Now, that's not XOM, ExxonMobil. Don't make that mistake. XOP is the oil exploration ETF. So that's companies that are looking for oil as opposed to companies that are actually producing oil. And then crack. No, that's not crack cocaine. And it's not even the crack spread, which is a relationship between futures prices. This one is actually the refiner's ETF if you want to invest in the companies that refine crude oil into gasoline and other finished products. Patrick, what do we make of all the price action and the different performance in these different categories?
You know what? What I wanted to capture by overlaying them is actually a thought that to build upon what we talked about at the first part of the show, which was that oil was breaking $75, almost hit $76 on the upside. And it seems like oil itself is accelerating. Typically, one of the things that I've noticed in the past is that when we are seeing big moves in the commodities, sometimes you would see these energy components of the market actually front run the breakout. And you tend to have people positioning themselves along the energy markets to participate. But what's interesting is that as oil breaks to these fresh new highs and is running on the upside, what we're actually seeing is a lack of participation at all amongst the energy stocks in the last few weeks. And it's almost like that traders are using the strength in oil to do a little bit of rebalancing or even some outright selling in their energy exposures. And I don't know if I want to overread into it, but it's something I'm going to continue to watch. I mean, if oil is autopiloting up to $80 and the energy stocks don't participate, then it might be a tell that it's time to potentially hedge or even reduce energy stock exposure into that strength.
Well, Patrick, I concur with your conclusions, but I get there in a different way, which is I really think that we are in something of a physical supply squeeze right now. And it's an unusual one because there's plenty of oil in the tanks in Cushing, Oklahoma. If it turns out to not be the right grade that can be delivered into the WTI contract, that can put a squeeze on the WTI contract. But I think there's actually more oil there than people realize. But in any event, Patrick, we're going to leave it there for today's show. Listeners, be sure to check out page 12, where you can sign up for a free 14-day trial of Patrick's service. Get Patrick's chart decks every day, not just once a week. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book that we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to an interview with Jem Carson on the Fed will lose complete control of the long-term rates, and a link to a variant perception article, Housing, the Inflation Dog That Has Yet to Bark. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, that's Eric spelt with a K, and myself, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.